My name is Mark Schwain, and this is a session entitled Knowledge, Character, and Community. Let me get this out of the way. Let me just speak a bit by way of introduction. There are four sessions this week that I'm doing that are all on the subject of education, and more exactly on the subject of the spirituality of education. Began yesterday with a session that was heavily attended, I suppose, because it was in part going to bring forward what was wrong with education. And I think lots of folks had contributions to make, thoughts about that issue, what was wrong about education. Today, what I hope to do for this hour is to explore the connections of among the three words in the title of the session: knowledge, character, and community. This is driving toward a more positive construction of what education in the best sense of that word might be. And I will proceed this time as I did the last time in all of the sessions, which is to try to speak for only about half of the time that we have together, and then only to set in front of us some terms and ideas that then I hope we can talk over and think through together. Because as you will see in the course of my remarks, I think that the fundamental mode of learning is, and teaching for that matter, conversational, that is a corporate process of inquiry and thoughtfulness together. So that's how I will work. A little bit about myself. This is repetitive, I know, for some of you. I'm currently a dean of an honors college and have taught in very many different contexts in higher education for about 20, 25 years now. But I think all of us in the room are qualified through our life experiences, and perhaps because most of us are involved as educators in an extended sense of that term, to speak about this subject. So let me just begin and set before us some terms and ideas, and then let's talk. Let me begin with a quotation here. This comes from the 3 years ago, the annual report that Derek Bach, who was then the president of Harvard University, makes to the Board of Overseers. And in that report, he makes the observation that universities, he says, are obliged to help students learn how to lead ethical and fulfilling lives. And then he continues, this is a direct quote, the professors, however, are trained to transmit knowledge and skills within their chosen discipline, not to help students become more mature, morally perceptive human beings. And so he cites this as a kind of problem. The professors in colleges and universities are trained to transmit knowledge and skills in their discipline, chemistry, geology, physics, literature, but not to help students become more morally perceptive human beings. The implication then, which he develops subsequently, is that the faculty then has to be somehow cajoled or exhorted or otherwise urged to attend to those other matters in addition to the teaching of chemistry, physics, biology, whatever. And in other reports, not Bach's, and in other colleges and universities, what often happens is that it's thought that the faculty is charged with cognitive development, transmitting knowledge and skills, and the character formation part, the training to become more morally perceptive and ethically sensitive human beings, falls out to something like the Dean of Student Affairs. So it's sort of a compartmentalized operation. Now this is important to all of us, it seems to me, because whether or not we wind up teaching in colleges or universities, most of us who are involved broadly in the whole enterprise of education have at one time or another studied there. And so the kind of observations that Bach makes and the kind of experiences we've had are important in signaling something rather unique in the 20th century when it comes to thinking about the relationship between what it is that we know and what it is that we are. On the one hand, in Bach's statement, faculty trained to teach us knowledge and skills, but when it comes to ethically perceptive human beings, the kind of human beings we are, that's somehow unrelated. At least the faculty is in charge of one thing, somebody else is in charge of the other. And what I want to explore today in the half hour, 20 minutes, is the notion that, as a matter of fact, the ethical and the knowledge are really inextricably interconnected. They can't be and ought not be taken apart, either institutionally by locating one place, one the other, or in other ways, in the way people speak. Now let me just try to get to some illustrations of what this problem is from our common life. We'll often find people saying something like, well, he or she is very intelligent, but I wouldn't trust the children or my friends with them for more than 5 minutes. In other words, we tend as a people often to think of excellences as being somehow divided up into different compartments. Thus, the person's a whiz at history, but a rat at personal life, etc. And what's interesting about that, we chuckle because we recognize that we ourselves have maybe made comments like that or observations like that. And what's funny about it even further is that there have been times in history, perhaps one could argue for most of history, in which those kinds of comments just wouldn't have made any sense. That is, the notion of human excellence was one in which the intellectual, the spiritual, and the moral virtues were thought to be of a piece. And so you just wouldn't sensibly speak in the way that we frequently do. And the suggestion is that we tend to speak that way and to make remarks like that in part because the educational system invites us to begin to split off one of these things from the other, the cognitive from the ethical, both of those from the spiritual. And what I'm going to try to do in a few moments is to suggest that this makes no sense and to put forward a positive account of what it means to learn, what it means to know, what it means to be in community, what it means to shape character. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the key terms in the address and then open it up for conversation. So let me say a few things, first of all, then, about character. I'll come back to knowledge at the end. What do we mean when we speak about human character? Well, it seems to me that what we mean by human character is obviously the kind of human being that we are, that we've become. And we can't talk about character for very long without talking about virtues. So we begin to describe one another as courageous or generous or cowardly or selfish or, to take some other virtues, temperate or intemperate. In other words, it has to do with what we're constantly disposed to do and to be in life. Okay? So that we're not talking about people who simply, when faced with a quandary of one kind or another, or when faced with a sudden decision, stop to reflect, grit their teeth, think what's right, and do it, but who quite naturally behave in a courageous manner, let's say, when faced with a situation that calls for that virtue. People don't stop when, in other words, you're going down the path and confronting a bear, suddenly on the path and stop and think, what's the courageous thing to do here, and then do it. People become habituated to behave in a cowardly or a courageous way, so when faced with a bear or when faced with other situations that call for courage, they simply behave courageously. Okay? These are things, virtues, as we were talking about a bit yesterday, that are finally formed in us through a long process that begins from birth forward. They're not something that happens suddenly One can't listen to a lecture and suddenly become, on the basis of hearing it, courageous, generous, etc. One is formed that way from the beginning. One's in a constant process of formation and reformation. But the point is that virtues are something like habits, dispositions. Okay? So that's all I want to say about character for the present. Now, what's the relationship between character and community? It seems to me that the matrix, the context within which human character is shaped and formed, is always finally a communal one. That is, it's by virtue of living with other human beings who are of a certain sort and who honor certain kinds of virtues and who practice them, that we, by virtue of those folks' example and folks telling us early on, this is not the kind of thing you want to do, this is the kind of thing you do, so that we then become habitual in becoming, when faced with a situation, generous people, that we become generous. So in other words, our characters are formed in community, not again by reading books, not again by sudden infusions of values, but by living together with others in a certain way. You couldn't live, to give an illustration, at Holden Village, it seems to me, for very long, very well, if you weren't, after a time, disposed to treat the natural world with care and with affection and with responsibility. And that's not so much because somebody wrote a book about this, though there are plenty of them in the Koinonia and in the Portal, but because in the way that we eat, in the way that we're highly conscious of sorting when we discard any waste material into three separate bins, we're conscious of the fact that that gets sorted, much of it recycled. So in every little thing that we do together as a community, that kind of virtue, okay, is instilled within us. And we couldn't very long function very well in this community if we didn't finally become disposed on our own, without someone's telling us or preaching to us, to make those kinds of distinctions between compostables and non-compostables and so forth and so on. We just wouldn't flourish in the community if we didn't do that. And so after a time in living in this community, most of us, not all, but most of us would come, it seems to me, to have a higher sense of responsibility for the natural world. So that's an example of what I mean by virtues being shaped in community. Let me give you another illustration from our collective experience. I know most of you were either at the forum or at the session that was held just before Vespers, in which we heard three folks give us their own stories. And before they gave us their own stories, they had a set of sort of ground rules up on the board about how we would relate to one another in the questioning period and so forth. And in effect, one could summarize all of those rules under a heading something like charity. That is to say, we were going to treat one another in the kinds of questions we asked, in the quality of our listening, in the quality of our response, with a kind of charity toward one another. That word was never used up on the board, but if you had to kind of locate those rules, they were kind of guidelines for human beings thinking together to treat one another in a charitable manner. Again, I think that most of the conversations we have here at Holden, though they can be intense and there can be disagreement and there can be conflict, and there is from time to time, still there's a kind of tone in the way people treat one another's ideas and the way people treat one another that tends toward the charitable. So that living in this community over a long period of time, it seems to me, again, would tend to form all of us, though we'd still have separate personalities, to be sure, we would become, most of us, more charitable by virtue of living in the midst of other charitable people, learning from those examples, and just finding that that's the way one ought to be. And one would find oneself being that way quite naturally. It would become, as people who've written about virtues put it, a kind of second nature to us. We may not all have been born charitable, but by virtue of living in a community, that practices as a communal virtue, the virtue of charity, we ourselves individually would become more so. Okay. So much for character and community. Now we come to the sort of key and difficult term, which is the first one in today's title, and that's the term knowledge. Many of us tend to think that when it comes to learning, when it comes to having knowledge about something, some of us conjure up in our mind the lonely and solitary moments we've spent in our studies, in front of a typewriter, on a long walk, engaged in the process of thinking, in an effort to have knowledge, in an effort to learn something. We oftentimes think of learning as fundamentally a solitary enterprise, and knowledge acquisition as something that finally each individual has to do for him or herself. Many of us think of it as an individual enterprise. What I want to suggest now is that in lots of contemporary conversation going on in our culture, people are coming more and more to see knowledge as something that is socially and intersubjectively generated, and socially or intersubjectively, and intersubjective is just a fancy term for in conversation with or in dialogue with one another, that is finally how we come to have knowledge. And whatever we turn out to mean by knowledge, and there are many definitions which we won't enter into today, but whatever we happen to mean by knowledge is also itself a matter of what communities agree to as counting as knowledge. So the meaning of knowledge itself and the way in which we come to have it is seen to be fundamentally communal, fundamentally social. Now let me give you some illustrations of that, and then we'll open this up for a conversation. Let's think a little bit about thinking. Let's start to reflect on our own thinking. What do we do when we think? What goes on? I think the most telling metaphor for the process of thinking is thinking is a process which involves a hushed because silent dialogue between self and self. That is, an internal conversation going on in our head. We sit and we're reading a book, and we say to ourselves, well, maybe it means this, and then some other voice within us, but it could mean that, and then some other voice within us, well, no, it probably means this. This you've all had this experience, a process of internal argument back and forth. Or even when you're doing mathematics, you're trying to work out a problem. Try it this way, and then some other perspective within you says, well, that doesn't look right. I'd better try it this way. So think of thought itself already as being a kind of internal dialogue, or maybe even an internal conversation. Can be just two voices, can be lots of voices. Now, a lot of the contemporary thinking about thinking says, we learn to do that. We learn to think through a process of internal conversation by virtue of having had good conversations with other folks first. If our conversations with other folks, parents, siblings, peers, are not terribly rich conversations, or they're not conversations at all, someone's merely talking to us as I'm talking to you now, and you're merely listening and not having a conversation, if that's the only experience we've had, the quality of our own thinking is going to be impoverished. Okay? So in other words, the notion is that thought is public before it becomes internal. It's very important to see that. Most people think that thought is private first and then becomes public. But the best thinking about thinking suggests thought is first public, and then when we go off in our studies or on our long walks, what we're doing is having a kind of more or less rich conversation based upon how well we've learned to converse with others in public. Okay? Now, once you buy this, if you do, and it's something we can explore, you can see what kind of striking possibilities this opens up for the whole process of education. Because now, what matters crucially in the whole process of learning is situating that learning within communities of human beings who not only are articulate and thoughtful in the sense that they're filled with ideas, but who are also thoughtful in the sense that they care deeply for each other. Okay? Because conversations can go wrong for many reasons. They can go wrong because people are logically sloppy, but they can also go wrong because people feel fear, anxiety, mistrust, whatever, toward one another. And so regardless of how logically consistent the conversation is, people for one reason or another aren't listening, aren't caring, etc., etc., and therefore the conversation can go poorly. My point is, if those conversations go poorly, the quality of the individual's own thinking is similarly impoverished. This picks up in a slightly richer way, I hope, on a point that this gentleman here brought up yesterday, which was the whole question of the individual and the group and the individual's well-being and the group's well-being in an educational process. If my account of knowledge formation is correct, there's just no way to make a very sharp distinction between those two things. That is to say, the better the group conversation, the better the individual's thought, the better the individual's thinking and his or her contribution to the group conversation, the better the group is going to think together. So there's a kind of, that also helps to define community, a kind of integral relationship among all the elements in a community. They all need each other to be at his or her best, because that's going to affect not only the quality of the conversation among the whole group, but as each person goes off separately to reflect, let's say you came to the forum last night. And let's say this whole question of eros, which we discussed, is a very troublesome one to you. It's troublesome to me in the sense that I haven't sorted it out yet, and it's very important to me and to our culture. Now, the point is, when you go off and reflect on that by yourself, the quality of that reflection is going to be better if the quality of that conversation in there was really good. Lots of folks said things that really you can refer back to and you incorporate within yourself, and you can hear that voice speaking. Now the voices within you were very rich. So your thinking is better. And I would argue that this applies to physics, mathematics, chemistry, geology, literature, philosophy, you name it. But basically, what's involved in learning those subjects is having a high-quality conversation, which you can only have, it seems to me, in the right kind of communities. So that, it seems to me, is how knowledge, character, and community are interconnected. And to go back to the quote I read at the beginning, I think it's just a mistake to ignore the fact that every time you convene a class, whether you're an elementary school teacher, a high school teacher, a college teacher, a parent, a peer, doesn't have to be a formal class, a conversation, and someone says, tell us about whatever the subject matter is, you're not only teaching the subject, you're also initiating people into the manners of learning. In other words, you're always teaching at least two things. You always are shaping character at the same time that you're getting people to think together about geology, chemistry, biology, or physics. And so I think Derek Bach is just mistaken in thinking that, he may be right that college faculty are not invited to think carefully about shaping human beings to become more morally perceptive, but willy-nilly, they and all other teachers are involved in that process, regardless of whether they're teaching calculus or literature or theology or biology, because the whole manner in which they treat what it is they're teaching and the other people who are studying together is basically shaping those people as ethical beings, as well as beings who come to have knowledge of a certain kind of subject matter. And I think one of the difficulties about our current situation is that we've lost sight of that integral connection and need somehow to restore it to what was once its very vital and significant connection. So I'm going to stop there, having sort of laid out the three terms, and invite you to comment or raise some questions about it. Yes, Dean?
I just want to push you on one thing. I think reading is a public activity in that it's not an internal dialogue in the same way that reflecting on something that happened is, but at least when one is engaged in the process of reading the words on the page, it's more, in my view, it's more like having a conversation with another person. I think that you'll agree with me, because partly my reflections are influenced by things that I've heard you say. And I have found it helpful with students to talk to them about that and to talk about the vulnerability of the author. You know, that once you put it on the page and tell it to people, you're so vulnerable, and that the need for the person who reads to think about the author's words as very, not exactly fragile, but quite the right way to describe them, but vulnerability, that their words are very vulnerable. There's no opportunity for the author to say, well, no, you haven't caught my nuance, let me try again. So I would just want to make that little nuance
addendum
on what you said, that I think that reading is really a public activity, and certainly authors think of having written as a public activity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking aloud now. In what you said, something just occurred to me that I'd known but never had made sense of exactly, and this helps to do that. You know, for years and years, for even centuries, people always read aloud. When people found the first person reading silently, they thought the person was kind of magician, a wizard. So that reading was actually done orally, it would have been thought, we take it for granted, you read silently, you know. And in a way, I think the reading orally was to give more of an obvious sign of exactly what you're saying is still true. So that there is something weird about reading silently, even though we just think, of course, this ought to happen quite naturally. Yes?
I think when I was a child, there was just a lot of memorizing of lists, terms, and that sort of thing. And I've come to believe that knowledge is relational. And so I think communication and dialogue is essential. I think you'll choose to grow and think in areas depending on how you relate to them or how they relate to you or to other people you know or care about. And I think it's important as a parent or as a teacher to kind of point out some of those relational settings in order for a young person or another person to think about their place within that knowledge or in that field of knowledge. Thus, I think that, you know, I tend to be from a liberal arts thinking, and there are certain things that I hang on to easier than other things. But there are elements of all fields and all disciplines that I am interested in, depending on how I relate to them or they relate to me or my life. And I think it's just real important for teachers to understand that in order to give out tidbits of knowledge and have them hang on to me.
Stand there inertly instead of being at
you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, not all teachers are the rock. Don't worry about it. Just try to get out of the course what you can. And hope that he doesn't teach character the way, at least not the type of character he or she might be in some cases. I think theoretically what you're saying is wonderful and unfortunately very true, but you know, to say, okay, we're going to give you these two bags when you go out there, this is the knowledge and this is the character, and we want you to teach them equally, or to say, this is your subject matter and you're going to have different methods of presenting them, that matter, some of it humorously, depending upon what type of person you are. But on the character side, we want a degree of consistency, you know?
Yeah.
You know? I'm just struggling with how you monitor that and how you even allow it sometimes.
I think you're really asking two questions, which we might explore together. The first one is, what do we do insofar as the basic framework I've set out has some merit? Let's supposing it does for the moment. What do we do then when we encounter our children, our friends, others matter to us, and are in situations where the teaching is not very attentive to the kinds of things? What do we do? Why don't we explore that one first, then we'll come to the second one.
And by the same token, Mrs. So-and-so is a wonderful person. Yeah, I know, but I'm not learning anything.
I understand. Any responses there? What do we do in view of the fact that that's much more what we're apt to face in reality? Situations that are much less ideal than we'd like them to be, both for ourselves and for others who matter to us. Yes.
I think here again is a decision-making skill that you would hope to develop yourself or develop in others, so that in relation to you, something comes at you and you can choose to toss it out or choose to take it in. If you have a teacher who's a dink, you would be able to make that choice yourself and sort out things that are coming at you. That relates to me, that has no relative significance, and be able to make that choice. We've told our four children that we hope that they can develop motivation within themselves to learn what they want to learn and to be zealous about that, and so that they can learn in spite of or together with the instructor. Hopefully that they are developing skills that, and I feel that all four of our children have been able to develop skills so that they can let some things lie, let some things go through or close the door or whatever. But I think that's a crucial part of knowledge skills, are those personal decision-making skills.
What about credibility, though? I mean, it's one thing to say to your child or to yourself, this is the person who is teaching. This is the person with the knowledge. That's one thing. But we want you to know that you're also there to learn character. Now, you don't verbalize that, but the implication is that... And they come back saying, from that I'm learning character? Or worse yet, yes, from that I'm learning character. And this is what I'm learning, that I should be sexist and that I should care. Or whatever, I mean...
Okay, why don't you jump in?
Well, I think to a certain extent, in at least the traditional settings, education, we're asking the impossible. When you have one teacher, 25, 30 students that they're with, 50, I'm talking about junior, senior high level, that they're with for 50 minutes at a time, and they've got a curriculum, you know, that's booked in, that's for the year, you know, being responsible for certain test results, or there's only so much of both that's going to happen.
But character is a big part of Mark's argument, is you can't not teach character. And I would say one of the things that we do then is to say that to each other and to not pretend like there's any such thing as neutrally teaching someone their multiplication table. It's just impossible. We never are in contact with each other without having some impact that's more than cognitive. And I don't mean more necessarily that it's more valuable, but it's in addition to cognitive. We always, so that if one of the things that the institution does is teach values, or to say, we think it's more important that you learn to pass a test, that you get high test scores, than that we worry about whether or not our teachers in our system are sexist or racist or abusive of children. So that we sort of bought into this illusion, in particular, I think, in public education, that there's such a thing as objective knowledge. And that all you have to do is have someone who has that. If you have a clean pneumatic tube idea, and you just push it through, and then the students get it, and then they're okay. And we all know that that's not the case, that some teachers have given us confidence, you know, and some teachers have made us feel humiliated. When people ask me, how did I get to be a historian? Well, the most honest answer I can give is that historians have encouraged me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, partly, it's that I have some natural inclination toward that way of seeing, some affinity with those questions. But also, those were the people who I said, gee, I'd like to be like you. And they were all very different from me. They were all men, they were all a lot older than me, but there was something about their character. I think this is exactly right. Something about their character that was attractive and that made me think, I can do that.
Yes.
I really appreciate what you said. I just graduated from PLU, and I think the point that character and ethics is taught whether the teachers think they're teaching it or not is really true. Two of my majors were anthropology and political science, and I had really different experiences in them. Anthropology all the way through was taught very ethically. From the first day, just whenever talking about any subject, was, you know, protect the people who talk to you. And when you go into a culture and study it, you have to be sure not, you know, don't wreck things and don't do that, and protect people's identity, and, you know, respect other cultures, respect other people and other ways of life. And it's really obvious that professors themselves had learned that and had, you know, that was part of their professional character and had become their personal character, that they were very, you know, open and accepting of other things, and that you always, you know, watch out for the well-being of other people. And in political science, in anthropology we never had an ethics course,
mm-hmm.
but it was always there. Mm-hmm. In political science, it wasn't. You know, we talked about structures of government, and we talked about policy making, and how to make policy, and this and that, and what is the best interest, what's the wisest, most, you know, realist policy making thing. But this last spring, I had my senior seminar in anthropology and the senior seminar in political science. And in anthropology, we talked about how to be an anthropologist and what you do. And we did, you know, we talked about ethics. And everybody in there was just, you know, we were all very personally involved and really concerned about, well, if we become anthropologists, we want to make sure that we carry on ethics and all that. And in political science, every one day, I went directly from the anthro seminar, where we had just talked about ethics, into the Paul Fry seminar. And we walked in, and we were turning in papers, and somebody joked, it was a rough draft, and the professor said, well, I'll read it and turn it back and tell you, you know, how to improve it, what you need to do to get an A on it. And somebody in the class said, yeah, $20, right? And the prof kind of joked, and he said, oh, you don't really mean that, do you? And I said, no, heck, I'd pay $20 for you. And I went, wait, really? Now, everybody in the class, don't you think that you'd like to know that there are some things that you couldn't buy? I mean, isn't there some integrity here, or some, isn't there, don't you want to know there's something in the world that you can't buy with money that you have to earn? And seriously, 3/4 of the class said, no! And he just went, well, maybe we should have a class on ethics next year. But the guy next to me, I was really horrified. He said, come on, you know, if somebody gave you $200,000 to do something, you'd do it. And I said, well, it depends on what. And I said, well, you would. And he said, yeah, well, think of all the charities if you give the money to. And I said, well, you wouldn't. And he said, well, no, I wouldn't, but you would. But it was just really, you know, and then the class went on, and everybody just kind of chuckled. But I sat there and looked at my little ethics packet from anthropology and just thought, you know, the difference in this, just the difference that, you know, we've had this conversation, and then the class just went on, and we talked about implementation of a housing policy or something. But, you know, it somehow through the 4 years, all of these senior graduating majors had never been taught that, you know, political science has to be applied with, you know, some understanding for the world and for other people and stuff. And it was just a really stark contrast. And the anthro people never intentionally sat us down and said, you have to, well, they did, but I mean, just, but every class, all through, in linguistics, it was an ethical linguistics.
I think that's a very important testimony, and I think what you've also identified is something which institutionally is happening all over the country. That is to say, people, the university has sluggish reactions to things, and one thing they've reacted to sluggishly but typically is the concern for virtue, and what they have decided to do is to then, their response is often add a course. There's a problem, we'll add a course. So what we really need in the business school now is a course in business ethics, and what we really need in the medical school is a course in biomedical ethics. And what we really need, I mean, I think eventually, clearly English departments will have to have a special subfield called English ethics and so forth. I mean, this is further demonstration of my earlier point and your testimony that in some areas, there's just thought to be complete divorce between the subject and the manner in which it's taught on the one hand and its ethics, biomedical ethics, business ethics, legal ethics, etc., on the other. And your testimony gives a great illustration of the difference in.
Yeah, I just want to share a story. Once upon a time, I used to be the dance fast at the University of Chicago. And I can recall one evening, probably the most crucial evening of my ministry there, we had about 20 graduate students, because UNC is primarily a graduate school. And one student was talking about his learning at the Div School and how the Div School taught him to argue. And that, for him, was the virtue. But then that brought up a whole series of, if you will, confessions, is that these students had realized that they had enrolled and accepted at UNC because of its premier status, but they had suddenly come to the realization that they were not going to be Nobel laureates, that they were not going to get teaching jobs at prestigious schools, that they were probably going to, many of them, teach at small church-related schools. And at that point, they realized that some of them had bought into the myth of the University of Chicago, that that's what they were going to be. They were going to be premier people. And then they were at a church who, some claimed, just prolonged their adolescence by relating to them as, quote, just students. And they suddenly became, you know, cognizant of the fact that in this community, that they just could be themselves. That, yes, in one way, to be taught to argue was a virtue. But this fellow, you know, I need to be more than that. Who can I look to? Because I cannot be vulnerable in the classroom. He would say to me, I sometimes feel I have to think of my question 6 months before I ask it in order to not be vulnerable in this classroom. But in this community of students, and these were divinity school students, music students, natural sciences, the sudden realization that this myth had suddenly been pulled apart and they were not going to be Nobel laureates, but they had to be mature people was what they wanted to work on together. And that was outside of the quote university community, but that was in a community of characters that they came to call the church.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm going back a little bit to what you were saying. Looking at the whole issue of teaching and learning, and that teachers teach from their own personal belief systems, and that's a basic that we don't all discuss a lot. Like you said, some teachers humiliate you, some teachers encourage you. And I am wrestling with the same question you are as I look at my 2.5-year-old going to public schools, being involved in the public schools, in a position of working with classroom teachers in my building, knowing what I want. And I was reflecting on my experience and working on my master's degree at the University of Minnesota in the first quarter of course, I didn't know the professors to take, and so I ended up with classes. And I just have to ask the question that can we, in fact, learn ourselves being in a situation that is not in cooperation with our own belief systems as learners or as teachers, that the first quarter I took a child psych course and the professor was horribly intimidating. It was undergraduate students, but I've been in educational long enough to go, I am not intimidated by what you're trying to do because this is how I believe people learn and this is how what I believe is important. Now, how do I translate that to my 5-year-old or 6-year-old in that situation is what I don't know when they get into that situation. I think that's a real world situation. Now I can choose to go, you know, public school and take what comes. I sometimes even been thinking recently that maybe I'll go private school and have a little bit more selectivity and choose, but it's a real world situation, and I'm thinking that can I in fact impart in her own ability to be able to go into an adverse situation and gain from it in spite of the adversity placed in that situation.
Well, of course, the scary part to the question is that Mark's premise is absolutely true.
Yes, it
that,
is.
That both are taught.
It comes from the teacher's belief systems of teaching and of themselves and of the world, and it's there.
Yeah.
It is there.
You know, and I don't know what system is used in hiring and maintaining. Let's look at your knowledge and your degree. I see that you don't have a degree here in behavior or what I mean, you know, that's it's assumed that comes along.
I think that part of it, of course, comes to the realization that, after all, there are going to be many contexts in which a human being grows, flourishes, etc. Part of practical wisdom, which is one of the intellectual virtues, is basically the capacity to discern those situations which one can change. It's almost like St. Francis's famous prayer, you know, give me the courage to change the things I can and the serenity to accept the things I can't and the wisdom to know the difference. And practical wisdom, it seems to me, can guide someone into seeing, here is a situation where my youngster, my friend, that person for whom I care, could be injured unless the person has already come to have a sense of what's worthy of admiration and following and what's not. If they haven't, if they're not at that point yet where they can make those kinds of judgments, then I'm going to have to complement, ensure that the person is in other contexts in addition to this one so that he or she can come to flourish. On the other hand, at a certain point, I think what you say, and I certainly say this to a number of the students that come my way at age 18, is that look, part now of what education's going to be is that it's more and more the kind of responsibility you're going to have to find taking upon yourself, and making the best of bad situations is part of what it means to learn. I mean, in other words, here's a situation where all we're getting is a dry text and someone who has this primitive view of teaching as, you know, pouring this filled bucket into these empty ones, okay? And so now how can you, as a student with other of your peers, make capital out of that? which you can. I mean, I would argue that in most schools, you learn after a certain point in your development. You learn more from your peers than you do from your professors and deans, and the best that they can do is to create a framework in which that kind of mutual learning can flourish. But when you're talking about people who are 4 or 5 years old, you do have a different kind of problem. And it'd probably be good to hear some others who are ready to speak on that problem. What do you do with your 5-year old who's sitting in a situation where her or his character is being malformed? Yes.
You said some of the same things I was going to say, only much more beautifully. But in response to the younger children, I think it's so crucial when they are with a teacher for many, many hours than it is maybe in junior high or senior high or on, where you have just a smaller amount of time with them. And I think that different teachers' personalities encourage different kinds of students. So there's not a teacher for all students. But I think that you need to be aware, as a parent or a friend, you need to be aware of what is happening there. And then I think we have a responsibility to respond to that, and or to use it for a learning situation if you think that can be healthy. And to request a change in the middle of the year if what's happening is not healthy. I think sometimes you don't want to rock the boat, but we owe it to our the people we care about to do that, and that, I think, should be done. I also think the public education does not have a very good system for sorting out exceptional or excellent teachers and ones who are borderline. So then I think the parents have a big say in that. One of our children has been in a math class that's not a healthy situation, and we've talked about it around the table a lot. And I said, "We'll try this. We'll try that." And he has sorted out, because I think he's quite mature for his age, and he sorted out this class will be an entrance to higher steps and other things I want. For that reason, I will not dink around, and I will turn in what I need to turn in and do what I need to do to come out of it, so that it will be a bridge to get me someplace else. And I said, when I go to conference, what do you want me to say that will help or hinder the situation? He was doing much better at problem solving than I was, so we allowed him to do the problem solving because I could see he had a handle on this. And so now he's finished the class. We have no more children under him to go through. I owe it to the school and to all the other future students to write a letter or to go there and discuss the situation. I don't feel I have anything to lose now, and I don't feel that my children will suffer. But I think we need to be aware and to do that monitoring especially for the younger children and even some of the older ones who are vulnerable to.
I think you were next, and then
Beth. I guess you probably answered some of the things I was going to say. But as a parent and an educator, I can see both points of view. But I think, you know, we are somewhat able to protect our children from all those outside influences until they enter kindergarten or whatever. You put them on that kindergarten bus with a lot of fear and trepidation, and they come home and saying these things, and using these words and whatever that you've never used in your house before. So now we have another element to deal with. And I think it's real important as parents to become actively involved in children's education. And as an educator, I can see a lot of benefit with that. You know, get involved in the programs that are going on at school. Get to know those people in the faculty. So, you know, maybe get on a first name basis, have that teacher over for lunch, find out those things that are important to that person, and make some judgment to yourself. Is this the kind of a person you want to teach your child? Get involved in the activities at school and talk to other parents too. Maybe they're going through some of the same situations that you are with a particular teacher. Or maybe there's a child that's being terribly influential in a classroom that's completely destroying a classroom. I mean, I'm a special education teacher. I see that happen all the time. I teach behavior disorder children. Those kinds of things can influence your child. And I think, too, as a child grows, they learn how to sort out those things. But when they're small, they don't have those skills to make those decisions, and you really have to help them. And it's really important.
I'd like to say also that it's more than the teacher. I think situationally with the children that sometimes teachers are asked to work with, which then is an administrative issue and is a policy issue as to how you want your school to service the public. I mean, that's what we're doing, and I think it's the teacher, it's a larger issue in many cases of unhappiness depending on the larger situation.
Dick, we're going to let you have the last word here.
I would just love to see a greater discussion and awareness in the teaching profession and the teacher myself about this issue and this reality that we are indeed teaching values by how we teach whatever our subject matter is. I'd like to see that in our education as teachers and in our profession, because I think that is profoundly discounted in our society.
Yes, I think that if one wanted to start talking about how it's come to be what it is now, as you've just described it, it's that the people who train the teachers to do the teaching themselves have no sense of the importance and significance and meaning of this issue. And so at best, we have to rely on, for the most part, and there are exceptions, other institutions to do that, and thankfully there are some of them around to do that, whether it's the home or whether it's, as Bill said, his community at Augustana there in Hyde Park, who can minister to and support those U of C graduate students as they come to recognize what he described. But it ought to be in with and under the rest of what goes on at the university itself. That it's not is a real problem, and how to address that one is something we can maybe tackle in some subsequent sessions and conversations.